Today is September the 30th. Thank you. I brought some ideas for our little diagram.
Good.
Maybe we could chat after this.
Good.
If you still feel like messing with it.
There's definitely some projects I will complete.
Okay, all right. We'll talk about it. Ta-da! I'm gonna get some cream.
So lowly. She cut him like a Scotty face.
She didn't know what kind of dog she was.
She did, but she just took all the character out of the face. It's like they shave all the way around their eyes, and so now they're all like this. I was so furious. And she put a cold kerchief on him, and I picked him up, so I came off right away. Yeah, I was like, it's my puppy.
He's getting shaped by the collective.
Yeah. They'll shape you.
They will shape you.
But it grows up. It does.
Hey, Jenny. Hey, Jenny.
Well, you all hopefully got the email about St. Zeust. I checked in the text. Longing is on page 248. The first, second line of the first paragraph, no, second line of the second paragraph under instruction. A longing that stayed behind, blah, blah, blah. And then for our material today, page 249, second column, where it says number two, it is no small matter to acknowledge one's yearning. That was so important, I thought we ought to spend a little time on it. The German, in both cases, is the same. Sehnsucht. And just by...
Spell that for a second.
S-E-H-N... S-U-C-H-T.
Oh, nice.
So I dug around the internet and I found that wonderful page on Wikipedia where C.S. Lewis talked about St. Zeust, and I thought he did such a beautiful job that we really get clear what Jung is talking about, because it's the foundation of Jung, right here. You can see the link to Freud, because Freud talks about libido. This is libido. But where Jung goes with it, of course, is much different and more in line with the deeper meaning of that word, which I thought Lewis did such a good job explaining. And I'll just read through a couple of parts of his stuff. C.S. Lewis described Sehnsucht as the inconsolable longing in the human heart for we know not what. That's what I like so much. For we know not what. This is a Wikipedia reference. And the author mentions, when that's why I'm going into it, that this Sehnsucht is almost impossible to translate adequately. So we think of longing as, you know, sexual or romantic, and it is, but that is simply one manifestation of this longing. And I think the idea behind it is really that if we do not know what we're longing for, what we park it on is another person. But that's the way we are. I mean, it's not to say you should try to transcend it, but it's to say that behind that longing in an erotic sense is something far deeper.
Gary, not just another person, but it can also be an addiction or...
That, yeah, and in fact, does he say it here?
He does say addiction in
the... Sucht in German is addict, is addiction. Mm. And what does he say for saying? Yearning. So it's an addiction to yearning. But that's, be careful of that, because the idea of addiction really isn't in the word Sehnsucht. You might say so strong as to become an addiction. Impulsive. Why is this so important? Because I think every world religion says, get rid of it.
You think so?
Yep. Who knows what Christianity was originally, but have you ever heard a sermon from a pulpit saying, follow your longing? No. It's what you should do to not follow your longing, because your longing will get you into trouble. You bet your sweet barrier it will get you into trouble.
For your earthly longing, but they do talk about longing for the divine.
Right, but suppose the divine is, I told you the dream about the priest. And
right, but that's earthly. See,
but there's no distinction for...
For religion, though, it is a distinction. The yearning for God is much different than any earthly longing.
Right, that may be another way to put it.
Which would be sinful.
Yeah, that there's no distinction in the deeper sense of the word. Mm-hmm. Remember the dream of the priest who dreamt he was to witness the resurrection of Christ, and, mm-hmm. and she was a woman who wanted to make love, mm-hmm. and she ran. And he quit therapy, yeah. Then came down with a vascular disease. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I ran into him later. So the idea is you get out of this earthly stuff and you satisfy it in heaven, or you satisfy it by God. And what Jung is doing is reopening that whole question. Is that the only way to deal with it?
So, Gary, would it be safe to say that what Jung was saying was it is... I'm longing for the God or the God image, but you can't do it in a way that is prescribed to you by the collective,
right.
Including religion.
Yeah, or you could say that it is ultimately a spiritual longing which must be approached through the flesh.
I brought up the addiction because I thought of they had some kind of a thing that they had years ago when they started doing a lot of advertising against heroin, and there was a spike in heroin use afterwards, so they were trying to figure out what they had done wrong. They started to talk to kids who became addicted to heroin, and what the kids said almost universally was, well, I saw on TV there was this commercial that said, you'll lose your home, you'll lose your family, you'll lose your life, you'll lose this, that, and the other thing. They said, if it's that great, I have to try.
Oh my
gosh. That's what.
Hmm. Yeah, teenagers.
And I think that's why addictions are so hard to cure, because they really are a longing for the eternal. And if you get them out of the addiction, you've killed their reason for seeking anything in life. The tragedy of addictive work is you have to get them out of that. And that's what AA does. And I think then why they come into Jungian work is then we try to put them back into a search for the spirit, but now they've got ego strength.
Yeah.
but they didn't have ego strength before that.
And then an understanding that a spark of the divine, if you go back to Gnosticism, it is in matter. And so it's not that far of a jump from, you know, there is divine in matter on earth,
yeah.
Right? Then you can move to that understanding.
Yeah, in theory, there's not a big jump.
I know, but in practice, it's good.
In practice, the problem is, which we're going to see, is it generally leads you into destruction. And it generally means you have to break the moral code.
I think it's interesting how most evangelical people I know, many of whom I am related to, say that, not my fault, but they, you know, they would answer that question by saying that Christ is the answer to the longing, that the longing
yeah.
and yearning is no longer necessary, not because of some future thing, but because of your relationship with Christ. But then they do things that are so visceral, and it astonishes me. I mean, there is a huge problem with obesity in that community mm-hmm. because they, you know, just the delicacy food, and they never deny themselves that. But they're also, there's this big movement, spiritual warfare, and being a prayer warrior, and you pray the blood of Jesus over your enemies and over other people to bring them into the fold. And, you know, I have mentioned in passing that my understanding of Christianity is not really to war, but then, you know, it goes all to Old Testament and the shield and the sword and the flame and the hell. And it's like, wow, you guys spend a lot of time thinking about very physical
Absolutely.
Things. And
Absolutely.
It's kind of amazing because they think about sex and drugs and alcohol and decadence way more than I do. And, you know, it's because they're so busy telling you why you shouldn't do it, and I'm just kind of living my life going, you know, I don't really think about it. But I couldn't imagine my aunt posts four angels at each corner of us, north, south, east, and west, with flaming swords that bear the blood of our enemies because the blood of Christ has been prayed over us. And and her daughter said, well, I know I'm safe now because you want to come near that. You know, but I mean, she kind of thinks like I do, but like it's this barrier that somehow it's so dangerous.
Well, I don't remember much from divinity school. But one thing I do remember is one of my favorite professors saying, the moralist has the filthiest mind. They see dirt everywhere.
Yeah.
And the problem with a direct approach to the spirit is it requires a shadow projection. And what Jung is trying to do is reopen this whole question, how can we seek the eternal and not have a shadow projection? And the way to do it is to find the spirit through the flesh. Now, I wanted to also add a point B to the business of following your yearning is always or generally destructive unless you're able to reflect about it. So that's what he's going to be doing in these next pages, is saying, how can I both be true to my earthly longing and reflect on it so that it doesn't lead to destruction, but it does lead to wholeness. And that will be symbolic thinking. Linear thinking doesn't work. So he's not only reopening the question of what desire is, he's reopening the question of what understanding is.
Lewis says that this longing is never fulfilled.
Right.
And is itself sweeter than any fulfillment of human desire?
Well, I'm afraid Lewis falls into the same mistake as everybody. I'm tempted to say everybody except Jung.
But the idea is that this longing is the life force in us.
Right.
Okay. And that's why it's never really fulfilled, and you want to keep it alive.
so that you will stay alive in life?
Yes, but I'm not sure, where is that?
The concept of Zenzukt in Lewis's writings, the key ingredient of the experience, do you see it there at the beginning, bottom, is, as Lewis treats it, is that longing never fulfilled is itself sweeter than the fulfillment of any other human desire.
Yeah, see, that's the split. Can you see the split right there?
Mm-hmm. But I can see how the Romantic era picked that up in this, you know, they would rather die of longing for another person than actually ever engage.
Absolutely. And they did.
And absolutely, yeah.
Where we'll be going is within that longing is another intention. And the art of living is knowing how to work with the images the longing generates so that the longing leads you to its intention, not simply the obvious object of desire. But you can't get to one without the other. That's the price that has to be paid.
Would it be fair to say that even God needs to experience through the flesh?
Particularly God. For Jung, this is the way to God.
But for God, it was the way to God, right? I mean, he didn't really understand what was going on until he took on human form. So until he experienced...
That would be a way to look at it.
Desire, fear.
Yeah. But the problem is the redeemed condition is up in heaven. So it's like Christianity approached the problem and then it got a little too hot, so it took the solution up to heaven.
Right. But Christ doesn't say that the redemption is in heaven. Christ says the redemption is here and the reward is in heaven, but there doesn't, I mean, he is arguing for a place that is very nearly the same.
Well, if you understand like that, then yes, then right. But I was talking about the church has done with it is to bifurcate it.
Well, yeah. But the church is not God.
Right. But it thinks it is.
Yeah.
Not the only one.
If everyone would understand it's really me, we'd all be great. But, you know, nobody gets that I'm God, so we're stuck with the church.
Gary, in one of these things, he was the fourth one.
The first page, Jane?
On the first page.
Okay.
Right above contents,
mm-hmm.
it is sometimes felt as a longing for a far-off mm-hmm. country, not a particular earthly land, which we can identify. Furthermore, there is something in the experience which speaks to that. I suggest mm-hmm. far-off country is very familiar and indicative of what we might otherwise call home.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that interesting. Home
yeah.
and longing are linked.
Absolutely.
Okay. So it's almost as if then this yearning or longing is calling us back home, eventually to wherever we end up.
To the self.
To the self.
Absolutely.
And it often has this bodily component to it.
Right.
Where you feel at home. Mm-hmm.
On that second page, just I won't read that whole italicized paragraph, but what I like what he says is, well, I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you, the secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia or romanticism. We try to give it a label to box it and to take away its power.
Where is that, Gary?
The italicized quotes, at least on mine, it's on page 2.
Mm-hmm.
In speaking of this desire,
yeah.
Probably depends on your printer where it shows up.
Oh, here. It's page 81.
Our communist expedient is to call it beauty and behave as if that had settled the matter. Everyone see where I am? I just like what he's doing is saying we try to give it words to define it and then exclude it from the problem. Well, we call it beauty, we call it nostalgia, we call it romanticism. And it is simply the primary machine of our soul. Yeah.
The image just popped into my mind from that DVD when he's saying, I don't know if you saw, where he's saying home, it's that same.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't know where home is.
Home, home.
Yeah, home.
Home, home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all I wanted to say.
But just what you were saying, we think since of us, if we give it a name,
then we define it.
Then we like it. Okay, come song.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then Kathy very kindly gave us a text from Rutherford, who knew 30 languages.
Wow.
I'd be longing too if I knew 30 languages. And what I thought was so important is how it ends unresolved. And that's so typical of romanticism. The longing starts and then they just sort of fade away because they don't have a tool for understanding its meaning. And what Jung brings is a tool to understand its meaning. And what we're going to see out of Jung's longing, maybe hopefully we'll get to it today, is it's the birth of Jungian psychology. Jungian psychology was embedded within Jung's longing. Then it isn't a dreamy, unfulfilled opium state. What have you got there, Kathy?
I also have Goethe's. It should be blessed longing. This person translated it blissful. Selig is blessed, right?
Yeah. See how it gets mixed up right away?
Mm-hmm. Is that everybody? Jane, did you get one more
around?
One more. Okay. But does everybody have one? But I thought this said so much more than, you know, than the Gestupa sense. This whole idea that you have to feel it, you have to burn in it,
right,
and so you die. That fourth stanza, you know, just where he says, poor moth, you are burned to death, and as long as you have not attained it, this, die and become, you will only be a gloomy guest on this dark earth. And then there's a quote at the bottom here. This quote I found, the road from intensity to greatness passes through sacrifice. This was a subtitle to a Rilke poem called Turning Point. And he quotes Rudolf Kastner, who was an Austrian writer, critic, and cultural philosopher. And I just think that's so beautifully.
Be careful with the word sacrifice.
I know, but Jung did have to sacrifice something.
Just so it's not the Christian sacrifice.
Right, right.
There is a sacrifice involved, but that's, I think, one of the difficult things in dealing with it. But it's not giving up the desire. It's letting the desire fulfill itself. But I think what Goethe ends with shows that he understood something. Pick up a pipe for yourself to make the world a little sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure about that last.
I don't know what that. It would be interesting to see the German. I have the German at home. I didn't bring it.
Because if the guy translates Selig as blissful, he's already caught in his mommy complex. But, I think Jung solved the problem. I don't think anyone did up to Jung. And that's what we'll be looking at today. how do you live with it and make it creative?
And make it what?
Creative. Or how do you live with it so that it makes you creative? Might be a better way to put it. So you happy with that? Thanks, Scott. I like what he says. In a way, it dovetails right to Goethe. It's no small matter to acknowledge one's yearning. Of all the questions we ask ourselves, usually the last one is, "What do I want? What should I do? What's the right thing to do? What will the neighbors like me if I do?" For this, many need to make a particular effort at honesty. See where I am?
No.
Oh, page 249, the second column, little box number 2. What we're doing, remember, now we're picking up with Elijah and Salome again. So Salome would be longing, Elijah would be understanding. But now he's back to tell, you can't get to Elijah without Salome. So that's what he's saying. All too many do not want to know where their yearning is because it would seem to them impossible or too distressing. You know, where was Jung's longing? To Tony Wolfe. It seemed mighty impossible and mighty distressing, but he had to accept it. If Jungian psychology had been developed then, would he need to have had a relationship with her? I have no idea. That's the question I've always asked. And yet yearning is the way of life. See, boom. Christ says, "I am the way." Here he says, "Yearning is the way." Actually, I think they're really the same, but how do you get from one to the other is the big challenge. If you do not acknowledge your yearning, then you do not follow yourself, but go on foreign ways that others have indicated for you. So you do not live your life, but an alien one. But who should live your life if you do not live it? Apropos what you were saying, Tammy, in the next paragraph, if you give up yourself, you live it in others. So all that fundamentalism projects their unlived life and demonizes it onto others. I don't think I've ever seen a Nazarene who wasn't a psychopath. I'm serious. Underneath, a huge psychopathic shadow. Yeah, in a way, you're sort of grateful, you know, at least they're not, well, I was going to say at least they're not beating their wives, but most of them that I've seen are. It's an attempt to control the psychopath, I would say, rather than say, "Okay, psychopath, we're going to have it out." But then you'd have to admit you have the tendencies you're blaming everyone else for having.
So you're saying psychopath as opposed to sociopath?
Oh, sociopath, okay. Yeah.
Psychopaths.
Well, sociopath is just a new word for psychopath.
There's two different psychopaths, which we get it. In my understanding,
I think they're the same. Okay. I mean, it's the ability to murder without guilt.
And I think the sociopath has a little bit of that conscience, but a psychopath has no.
Oh, well, I meant psychopath then.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gary, in the footnote, the very last line, you should confess your longing and what you long for to yourself. Thus you satisfy your pleasure and nourish your forethinking at the same time. That last sentence.
Yes.
Could you just speak a little bit about
thanks.
How you nourish your forethinking?
Thank you for mentioning that.
Okay.
Actually, I skipped over it. I didn't want to, though. Let's just go up a couple lines and look at that whole footnote.
Okay.
See, we're about halfway up the quote. It says, desire without forethinking gains much, but keeps nothing. Therefore, his desire is the source of constant disappointment. Thus, Elijah calls Salome back. If pleasure is united with forethinking, the serpent lies before them. See, that's what Jung is struggling to find a way to do. How do you unite forethinking and pleasure? Forethinking is maybe a difficult word. The natural word I would have used would be symbolic thinking or imagistic thinking. Well, I think he says forethinking because in psychiatry, this associative thought process is thought to be the foundation of linear thinking. So he's calling it thinking before thinking, which is thinking in images. Remember I told you the story about the Basuto?
Mm-hmm.
We think in image, we think in pictures and you think in thoughts. So forethinking is thinking in pictures. It's dream work. So that's what he's working on. If we can bring imagistic thinking to desire, then snake is life based in passion. Then the snake can be born. If you just have Salome and you just have pleasure, you end up just having a life of dissipation. If you have thinking without pleasure, you end up an arid intellectual. So he's trying to unite the two. And when he does unite the two, we'll see Jungian psychology is born. Because Jungian psychology is the thoughts that came out of his desire.
Now, in this context, is pleasure equals desire?
Yeah, pleasure, passion, desire, longing, all the same. To succeed in something, you first need to deal with the resistance and difficulty. Otherwise, joy leaves behind pain and disappointment. So there I think he's talking about his own resistance to accepting what his desire was leading him to.
Now, are you back on the footnote?
Yeah, I'm back on the footnote. Okay. In other words, that we spend a fair amount of our time saying to people, what do you want and why aren't you going after it? Because it seems if you do, you'll get into a mess. Or you were told it was bad, or this is where the parental injunctions control your life, or societal norms and values control your life. Therefore, I drew near. I had to overcome the difficulty and resistance to gain what I desired, which I would take to mean overcoming his feelings about not getting involved with Tony Wolf. Because it's just at this time he was starting his relationship with her. 1913.
Do you think Emma was aware of what he was going through? Did he share that with her, you think? Did they ever say anything?
You know, I don't know, but have we already done it, or is it upcoming that... I think we already did it, where he's up in the mountains and Emma is with him.
Yeah.
I think she must have known.
Okay. I would hope.
That would... She certainly knew when Tony Wolf came by for Sunday brunch.
Right.
I think she must have, but that's a guess.
And how did he meet Tony Wolf?
She was his patient in 1910. And I don't know if there's a reliable source on this, but what I understood in the oral tradition, so to speak, Missouri, was they worked for a while, then they didn't work. They had no relationship, and then they started a personal relationship. So they took a break.
So it wasn't like Adler and his patient when they, you know, when they fell for each other and he had to keep away in order to allow her to process. There wasn't like that.
Well, see, we just don't know what was going on in that therapy, as far as I know. And presumably, they finished the reason that she came, which was depression. She got out of that. And then my understanding was they didn't see each other for a year and then took up a personal relationship. Whether that's accurate or not, I can't say. But that's what I heard.
They also had a professional, right? Because she was becoming an analyst at that
time. Well, after this.
After this?
Oh, after this, yeah.
Okay.
See, Jung wasn't even Jung at this time.
Okay.
He really didn't get to be Jung until
1928. There were no seminars at this time going on?
No.
That teaching?
That very first seminar started, the dream analysis seminar started, I think, what, 1928.
Okay.
See, so it hadn't started until this whole thing was over.
Okay.
This is his ninth sea journey, right?
This is his ninth sea journey, yeah.
And he was like 35.
Let me see, 1938. Yeah, 38.
If he had met Tony Wolf first and then the circumstances were reversed and he met Emma later, is it just as likely that he would have started a relationship with her? I mean, were these women so vital to him?
I think so.
He needed both.
I think you might say Tony Wolf was the imagination and Emma just solid reality. And as I understand it, I don't know exactly the year that he and Tony Wolf cooled, but as I understand it, what happened was that she, Tony, told him not to publish on alchemy. And you can see how could that relationship continue. So then Emma would have probably by then understood what was going on and was not afraid of the shame brought on by his doing this work, because he was considered a nut. And that's what Tony Wolf said, you know, people already think you're nuts. Now you're writing on alchemy, they're really going to think you're nuts. Because she was based in a very conservative family.
I wonder if it was maybe, perhaps important for Emma to be first because she was such a grounded personality that gave him a jumping off place that he might not have had she not been first.
I could buy that, yeah. I think I told you that the woman I worked with edited the collected works in German with Jung's daughter-in-law, the son's wife. And she said all the kids took after Emma. So she was, Jung was obviously a strong personality. She was stronger, apparently.
She had to be there. Right?
She had to be.
She had to be.
Yeah. When desire becomes the difficulty, it becomes seeing and follows forethinking. Therefore, I see that Salome's hands are pure with no trace of crime. My desire is pure if I first overcome the difficulty and resistance. No, I think we can skip down to that last sentence Kathy mentioned. Thus you satisfy your pleasure and nourish your forethinking at the same time. The idea is he's slowly, I think, coming to realize how desire and creativity are linked. How desire and imaginative creation are linked. And if he follows his desire for the purpose of... No, that's not right. Follows his desire open-heartedly and then finds the creative thought that comes out of it, he feels he has absolved his guilt. In other words, had he not gone with Tony Wolf, we would not be here today. We wouldn't have Jungian psychology. And I can think of five people who told me without my Jungian work, I would have committed suicide. So I think Jung was wrestling with this issue. I've got something to create. It's going to have terrific value, but in order to do so, I have to break the moral code and hurt people I love. Does that make sense, Kathy? The nourishing your forethinking. Yeah.
And Lewis mentions in his writing on that second page of the Wikipedia that this longing is a secret that we hold even from ourselves. And so the idea of it confessing your longing is like actually letting that secret go just to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we try to put that over here. We don't want to look at that. That's something that we don't want to acknowledge. We run away from it. So.
Yeah, and what Jung is trying to do is accept it, and then, but then, always asking himself, what's the meaning?
Right.
That's the distinction. And you can't say to yourself, oh, I'm going to accept this to get to the meaning. You got to say, I accept this because that's what is. Let's see what comes out of it. Because if longing is the way, then you simply have to accept it for what it is. He doesn't say longing that agrees with my thoughts is the way. This is what he's... And I think here he's really building on Freudian psychology. Because he realizes if you really probe desire, there's something within it. And that's where Freud stopped.
So libido would be life energy.
Yeah.
And Jung is taking that, go into that life energy, but go behind that and see what's...
Yeah, or go behind, go within it, that there is something wrapped up in it.
Okay, but you can't get there unless you go into it and feel it.
You can't get there unless you go into it and feel it, and you have to know the right way to question it.
Okay.
And have the right... cognitive processes to question it, namely the ability to think symbolically. Probably that too.
Yes.
Think symbolically. To get the meaning out of it. Because what that image, what that desire does, it produces images.
Once the desire is satisfied, then it goes away, right?
As, I would say, as the meaning of the desire is understood and fulfilled, then the desire will dwindle. That's what I think, yeah.
And isn't there something a little disappointing in losing that desire?
Yeah, probably.
But what you found is meaning.
But it can come back in many different ways.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't just transform
there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go away, it just transforms.
And people who achieve enlightenment often become very, very depressed immediately after achieving enlightenment because they realize that enlightenment, one of the pieces of enlightenment is understanding that it's not sustainable in the human condition. And so it gives a miraculous experience, and then the desire either goes away completely or it's stronger than ever, and it's not like you can just, you know, look in a mirror and go, whoop, there, I've got it again. And so it seems a little dangerous because there's something kind of comforting. If you're always longing for something, at least you know what you're looking for or mm-hmm. what you are, even if it's an unknown thing, you've got focus. When you get it, if it morphs into something else, you've got to start all over.
Except that Jung spent his whole life from that experience writing until his death. So what it did was he found meaning in his life and a direction and a task for his life. And that fed him like the yearning did. that then becomes the river of his life that he swims in instead of swimming away like the hero on that one image. Is that where you were going?
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. Okay. So we're done with that footnote. Go back up to the text, the last couple of sentences in the next to last paragraph on page 249. The image of the hero was set up for all and every age through the appetite for imitation. So you see why he contrasts the hero versus the way of longing?
The hero takes on what everybody else wants him to be, what everyone needs him to or her to be.
Okay.
And so that they then are not allowed to have their own desire.
Yeah. So what Jung is saying is selfhood comes through desire. Idealizing selfhood comes through mimicking somebody else. Apparent selfhood comes through mimicking somebody else. That's why the hero myth is so dangerous.
So the hero myth would be Jesus saying, I am the way, and people trying to follow Jesus. Mm-hmm. And the sustainable enlightenment way again would be,
yeah,
Jesus saying, I am the way, and people taking that to mean, and I am my own way.
Right. What we're going to see this business of, you know, Jesus comes up pretty soon, and Jung reinterprets it to say, I am the way, meaning I have to fulfill my individual life the way he filled his individual life versus mimicking his pattern. Absolutely. To live oneself means to be one's own task. Never say that it is a pleasure to live oneself. It will be no joy but a long suffering, since you must become your own creator. So when you create yourself, do not begin with the best and highest, but begin with the worst and deepest. There you can speak to the fundamentalist. Therefore say that you are reluctant to live yourself. Next paragraph, skip a sentence. If forethinking and pleasure unite in me, that's this idea of having a desire, seeing what images it generates in your dreams, and then putting those images into reality. Does that make sense? If forethinking and pleasure unite in me, a third arises from them. The divine son, who is the supreme meaning, the symbol, the passing over into a new creation. So that your task in life, your work in life, your creative work in life, comes out of the image generated through reflecting on desire.
Gary, in the vision seminar, Jung says sometimes it's a... it's the difference between blood experience and wine experience. Is it that one has to have a blood experience before one can do this symbolically?
Well,
we don't get to choose that, is what he said.
I think generally you start out with a blood experience. In other words, do you have to act it out, or can you just do this in your imagination? I think you have to act it out, personally. At first. And that doesn't exclude the fact that you then work with it, with your imagination. But what the images that are generated come out of that relationship. Maybe later you can meet somebody and work with that relationship symbolically. But I think our tendency, at least in this time period, is so likely to flee from the cooking in the desire, that to fully get the meaning of the desire, it has to be lived. And then maybe later, once you know what it's like to be cooked, you don't have to go through it again, but you can go through it in your imagination. So another way to say it is that symbol is an image of the person's need, why they're here, what path they are to live. That comes out of this union of pleasure and forethinking or imaginative thinking. I think we see him, remember, this is very early stuff. So I think we see him here trying to clarify what's going on. I do not myself become the supreme meaning or the symbol. See, the temptation is that when that image is generated, that you think you are it. So this is the beginning of the distinction between the ego and the self. What is born is my task, my work, my contribution, my song, if you will. It doesn't mean I become a super person. It does mean I am given very important work to do.
Can just see here how differently he works than Nietzsche.
Right. I bet you he was thinking of Nietzsche the whole time here. Because Nietzsche would have said, I am the meaning. Versus there is a meaning I serve. Huge difference.
But then Nietzsche would never have allowed himself to go into the yearning
right.
for a flesh
right.
human being.
Right.
You know.
Right. I do not myself become the supreme meaning of the symbol, but the symbol becomes in me such that it has substance and I mine. So that he gets his substance by understanding what his meaning is and then fulfilling it. Thus I stand like Peter in worship before the miracle of the transformation and the becoming real of the God in me. See how he gets close to Jesus. But then Jesus is an image of this meaning that's being generated, which he serves. Although I am not the Son of God myself, I represent him, and nevertheless as one who was a mother to the God. It might help us just for a second to remember what this is foreshadowing historically, which I think is Nazism, where that Nazi movement was based on a huge desire to become God. That was what was in the collective unconscious. That's what was knocking on Jung's door. And this is how he deals with it. In other words, that we might say it's still alive today, we have a need to become God. Look at the guys who were on the financial crisis. They acted like God.
Intoxicated by their own success.
Absolutely. No bounds, no rules. They set the rules.
Right.
That's exactly what God does. Controlling everything. That is a basic drive in the psyche, if not instinctually, certainly in our historical period. Probably due to the lack of belief in God, God falls into the psyche and possesses us to become like God. So you're going to see this in Jung, this wrestling with, am I God or do I serve God? And I don't think it means he's nuts. I think it means he's dealing with the drive that was starting to boil up in the collective unconscious that would later surface in Nazism.
So when he says, I do not myself become the supreme meaning,
right,
he's distinguishing there, the supreme meaning would be the self,
yeah,
image, right?
Or God even.
And that is very definitely separate from him, because
right,
he doesn't become that. He doesn't become the symbol of that.
Right.
That is one thing in the psyche, and he is another.
Right.
So he really makes that distinction.
Right.
So clear there.
So clear. Very crudely put, because it's 1913. But this is the origin of the ego-self distinction.
Is this also the beginning of the idea of the collective unconscious?
Let me think. Did he... That's a good question.
I'm thinking
I'll check on that, Tammy. I don't really know when he first used that. Let me check on that and get back with you next time. Make myself a note. If I remember where I put my note, we'll be in good shape.
It seems like, you know, the forethinking and pleasure unite in me. Even there, it's more physical. It's almost as though there's a joining. So you think more in terms of sexual, that creates this new thing, which would be, you know, it's almost like genetics. Every time that these two things come together, it creates something slightly different, but much the same, that can add to or take away from the whole. So
yes, I'll check on that. I'm tempted to say no, but let me be sure. Well, should we take a stretch? Mm-hmm. Enough light talk. Let's
let's do something happy here.
Something of a substance.